Scarlett Johansson was like, woke up one morning and was like, I've been making some bad decisions. That's clearly my brand. How can I make things even worse for myself and for communities I claim to support?
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 34. I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined by the wasp to my Ant-Man, Ebony Astor.
I don't like it.
Well, more importantly, we have a very special guest, comedian Jamie Loftus.
Hi.
This is a show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. In today's show, we're going to dive into Marvel's latest summer blockbuster, Ant-Man and the Wasp. And as always, we'll finish the show by all sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Exclusively for our fantastic backers, we've got a bonus segment with things and words, which will include why our very special guest has a Zamboni tattoo.
It is absolutely the best part of the episode. So if you're thinking about donating so you can get access to special drip perks, this is a for real drip perk that you want, because this story is straight up bonkers banana soup.
And Ebony, where would they do that?
D.rip/femfreak. That's D.rip/femfreak. If you didn't get it, hit me up on Twitter at Ebony Astor. I will be happy to walk you through how to give us money so you can hear about the Zamboni tattoo to end all Zamboni tattoos.
Look, even if you donate for 1 month just to get this story, I totally
I would. Listen, I ain't afraid to tell people how to be slick.
All right. Well, so we're so excited to have Jamie on the show. Jamie Loftus is a comedian and animator who wrote and starred in Comedy Central's Irrational Fears and co-hosts the How Stuff Works show, The Bechdel Cast, which I will be on soon.
It's true. We talked about Point Break.
We did talk about Point Break.
The first one, like the real one or
the only one. The only one.
But did you talk about how they tried to remake it? Or were you just like, we're pretending that doesn't exist?
We're pretending that doesn't exist.
Right on.
Which is like fair.
Aggressively.
Enough.
It's so bad.
All right. Well, I'm just saying, you know, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. So.
It's very true.
It's true. All right. We are missing our wonderful entertainment news correspondent, Carolyn Pettit, today. So, Ebony, you are going to do the honors.
Yeah, and so I apologize in advance to all of our three listeners for what you're about to hear. If you play Feminist Frequency Bingo, you're going to want to mark the square that says re-record, because we had to re-record this episode.
Don't give out our secrets.
You say that every time, Anita, and people love it. And the reason why I actually, like, it fucks up the schedule for our producer, but I secretly love it when we have to re-record, because it means I can hopefully fix the things that I fucked up the first time around. I'll make all new mistakes, but hopefully I will, you know, be better about the stuff I messed up the first time around. So, pop culture news. One, I want to talk a little bit about this hashtag Plain Bay. Do y'all know what I'm talking about?
No,
where this
I don't.
Woman, so this woman live tweeted her plane journey with her partner from New York to Dallas. And what transpired was, as they were boarding the plane, they noted that they were not sitting together. So they asked this woman, who was by herself, if she would mind switching seats so that they could sit together. The woman graciously said, yes.
Is this right. Yeah, okay.
And it spawned a whole Twitter thread, because she was like, she started to live tweet, you know, what happened during the plane journey. She's like, oh, so, you know, we jokingly said maybe you'll meet the love of your life. And then, you know, she sat down. It happened to be next to this straight dude, and they were both cute. And it turns out they're both trainers. And, you know, they really seem to be vibing off each other. And, like, she's taking photos, like surreptitious photos, and, you know, listening in on their conversation.
She blocks out everybody's faces, though, just so you know. Like, she's super respectful of their privacy.
Oh, okay.
Well, yes and no, right? So the fact that she was doing this, and the fact that it sort of took off on Twitter, like, it had hundreds of thousands of retweets and people, like, sending in, you know, their screenshots being like, oh my God, I am watching this. I'm more interested in this than people were interested in the moon landing or whatever. And it was this kind of feel-good story. But at the same time that it's happening, you had increasingly more and more people being like, yo, this is not cool. You know, even though the pictures you're taking don't show these folks' faces, you are, in effect, you know, making their private conversation something for public consumption without their consent. for your followers and for then anyone who participates in, you know, the viral thread, right? So this became this huge thing. So these folks are now going on like Good Morning America. They're trying to get jobs on BuzzFeed.
No.
Yeah, like it became this huge thing, right? Luckily, we are having, you know, more, as I said, more and more people being like, let's have a conversation about what it means that we appear to be, not appear to be, we are in this historical moment of constant surveillance where the lines between public and private have been almost completely eroded, right? And it can be used for good when it's in the service of like a marginalized community saying like, look how we're being treated by law enforcement, for instance, when they're filming, you know, like police stops or whatever. But often these regular schmegular folks are just going about their day flying on a plane and unbeknownst to you, the chuckleheads behind you, you know, are live tweeting your fucking conversation. You know, I read this really great piece about this, which we'll put the links in the show description from a writer, I believe her name is Tiffany Chow, about this very issue and about how for the entertainment of the masses, everything is now considered fair game. And consent is implied, such that we will take pictures of people waiting at the bus stop, at Walmart, you know, eating at McDonald's or whatever, and it's good for a laugh, and maybe we are not doing it to gain, you know, likes and retweets and cultural capital, but the fact is, we are all behaving as if we're watching a TV show, you know?
I have a question.
Yeah. Yeah.
This feels like a stupid question related to your larger, very important point. Is the couple who is spying on them going on TV shows and BuzzFeed and shit?
Or yes,
is
it the and other no, couple? This is very, okay. This is very important. The couple who was doing the live tweeting, the spying couple, yes, they are absolutely, you know, being feted by the news and, you know, like our endless kind of pop culture news cycle. But also, crucially, the dude who was part of the couple that was being observed kind of outed himself and was like, yeah, I knew you were taking photos. And he's kind of loving it, right? So he's gained this mass of Twitter followers and Instagram followers, and he's like deeply in it, right? The woman, however, has been doxxed off social media. She had to shut down all of her social media accounts because predictably the shit that came her way once people took it upon themselves to identify her was so appalling, was so gross, was and even if it was things, you know, which it was not, but even if it was things that were purely complimentary, the fact is this woman had an expectation of privacy that was denied to her and now no longer has that right and that privilege, right? So yeah. I just think it's very telling that when this kind of stuff happens, it is always people who are in already vulnerable positions that bear the brunt, you know, that bear the burden of this like hyper visibility. And I wanted to bring this up. And the reason why I'm bringing up that we had to re-record this episode is because I didn't bring this up the last time we recorded. And I was just reading more stuff about this. I'm going to link to the Tiffany Chow, please. And also to a piece by friend of Feminist Frequency, Anil Dash, also about, you know, the distinctions between the public and the private. But I wanted to do a self-own because when I first saw this tweet thread, hashtag Plain Bay, I was caught up in it too. And I was like,
it was
this is so sweet.
Yeah.
You know,
I was looking at it and I
couldn't
stop.
Funny and adorable. And I did find myself saying like, oh, at least she's not taking pictures of their faces. They're not easily identifiable. But of course, in this moment, when you can mobilize hundreds of thousands, millions of people in the service of identifying someone in the service of surveillance, of course, it's not hard to identify someone. And the fact is, even though those people were not, their pictures were not taken full on, the information she did provide made it that much easier for them to be, you know, recognized, right? So she's like, oh, they're both trainers. I hear that they both live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Oh, it sounds like he works at a bar. Like, it's just more and more steps such that, you know, okay, at that point, you don't even need to actually show a picture of the dude. Like, of course, people are going to be able to figure out who it is, mm-hmm. you know? So it's just, it's a kind of horrifying realization. And like I said, it's a horrifying cell phone, because at the same time that I'm having this like delightful little, you know, experience with these people I don't know over my morning coffee, later on that day, I'm grilling on my balcony wearing like the world's shittiest looking crop top. And I thought like, oh man, I hope none of my neighbors is watching me right now. And please God, don't let anybody take a picture and put it up on one of those sites that's like, you know, hot or not or whatever, right? Like I demand privacy for myself while at the same time denying it to others. I'm trash. So that's item one in pop culture news. Ebony is trash. Fill out your feminist frequency bingo cards.
That's the moral. That's the moral of this story, clearly.
I'm telling you, I'm trying to grow, y'all. I'm trying to be better, but it is coming in.
I got caught up in it, too. I was like, oh, this is so cute and charming. Like, yeah, but I am very conscious of being in public and people taking photos of me and posting them on things. Like, I know that I'm more visible, but like, it's not like I'm more visible because I was harassed.
Yeah.
Because people hate me. Like, so it is a thing that I think we move around in the world just being a little more fearful in a lot of ways. Or I do, because I'm so hyper aware of it. And like, it sucks because these people didn't ask for this shit. Not that anyone asked for it. Wow. This is great. Can we just use yesterday's recording? Because I'm already fucking this up.
Wonder producer Phil, if you could just Frankenstein this episode to make us sound as good as possible. Like, we're not going to sound great, but just, you know, do your best to make us sound like,
but
know,
no, for
educated,
real, I think
thoughtful
like,
adults.
The lines of between private and public just are so blurry. And I think that this is a real thing that we need to reckon with and understand.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, that's item one.
Jamie, did you want to jump in, Jamie?
The one thing that I noticed, because I was going through the pieces on this as well while you were talking about it, Ebony, is that the woman who started the Plain Bay hashtag, and this is the part of it I find the grossest and the most opportunistic, because ultimately, isn't a story like that kind of to boost the poster's following in some way? Like it does feel manipulative of like, and taking advantage of whatever's going on around you. And it's so case to case, but the woman who started this hashtag, like tweeted inside of 24 hours, tweeted at hello to my at BuzzFeed friends. You got any job openings, would love to create for you, winky face. And that to me is like the grossest part of like on top of the surveillance issue, on top of the invasion of privacy. We're so deep into the internet at this point that someone can invade someone's privacy without really thinking about it and then try to leverage it to get like more social media clout is like, oh boy.
it's gross. And, you know, I do want to, you know, like I said, confess like my participation in this, because after we have this, you know, this recording, I probably will head to BuzzFeed and I will check out, you know, some more listicles. It's like, look at these funny things that happened to people as they waited in line at Starbucks. Yeah. And it'll be folks that like, you know, tripped on ice or whatever and who were filmed without their knowledge or their consent. And I'll have a sweet chuckle and I will assume that, you know, there's no sort of like psychic or emotional effect to me having consumed that. But there is,
of course,
you know.
Yeah.
And so I just want to foreground, like, of all the people involved in this thing, let's not forget that the woman who was spied on, who had her private conversation, you know, relayed to the masses of strangers, has been driven off of social media for this. That girl was just trying to get home from New York to Dallas. She was just trying to get, can you imagine? Like, you just going to, you know, Whole Foods, spending your whole paycheck trying to get some artichoke hearts. Next thing you know, you got to delete your whole online presence because someone thought your sweatpants were funny and now the whole world wants to talk about it.
Yeah.
We're all trash. Moving on to more trash. Scarlett Johansson, Anita's third favorite girlfriend. Scarlett Johansson woke up one morning and was like, I've been making some bad decisions. That's clearly my brand. How can I make things even worse for myself and for communities I claim to support? So she has been cast in a role in a movie called Rub and Tug, which frankly, I wish I had stolen that name for my jug band. But anyways, Rub and Tug, about this real life trans man. who ran massage parlors, which were just kind of like thinly veiled fronts for prostitution. It's going to be a mob drama. And after being appropriately called out for this, the response from her PR team was, if you have a problem with this, you know, take it up with Jeffrey Tambor, Felicity Huffman, Jared Leto, who are also cisgender actors who have won, you know, critical acclaim for playing trans roles, as if to suggest that, one, people did not complain when they were playing those roles, which people did, both in and outside of the trans community, that it wasn't a problem then, so it shouldn't be a problem now. It is. But also this kind of like radical misunderstanding of the cumulative effect of cis actors playing trans roles, but not giving trans actors the opportunity to play trans roles or the trans roles that they overwhelmingly are only allowed to play in the first place. Like, it's just trash. But the thing that, like, is super duper garbage fire, dumpster, shoot it into the moon about this is that the director of this movie is the same dude who directed her in Ghost in the Shell, where she played
no
a
way.
Right? Like, at what point do you say to yourself, like, I refuse to learn a goddamn lesson? At what point are you just like,
that.
I'm gonna My dig God. Deeper into this shit?
Well,
right?
And also, just for reference, in case you missed that, she... that was a super whitewashing film where she plays a person of color as a white woman in Ghost in the Shell. So she's fucked up twice in big ways.
Yeah. And so there are many, 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 many wonderful trans activists, trans actors, artists, etc., who you can listen to, who can articulate much better than I can why this is a problem. I encourage you to go seek out those people. But the main thing is, like, identity is not a costume that white people can just don. You know, cisgender, straight white folks can just, you know, put on and take off like accessories. And also, let's not forget, like, in addition to the trans erasure, there's the fat erasure too, which, like, if you look at pictures, again, this is a real life trans man. Mm. Dante Gill was a fat man, right? And like the idea that this thin, conventionally attractive cisgender woman, like, how are you going to?
Are they
going to
put prosthetics on her like they did that?
This
bullshit
is like
Nina
it's so
Simone
gross.
Shit?
Thank you. Like it's so it's
because no
so
way she's
gross.
Gaining weight for the role,
right? You know, and so I'm just like the argument from, you know, like the doofuses on the internet is like, okay, Scarlett Johansson can open a movie. Like, you need to have a name actor.
They always say that shit.
Exactly, right. But if you never give trans actors the opportunity to take these roles, none of them are ever going to get to the point where they are name actors, right?
Right.
Such that they are allowed to take these kind of roles. But also, like, y'all... Jamie, I know you just met me, so you don't know this, but Anita, come on, vouch for me. I'm trying to become a better person. Mostly. On three days out of the week, I'm trying to become a better person. But y'all, let's not act like Scarlett Johansson is a good actor. Come on.
Yes.
Like, it would be,
okay,
this would even be justifiable if she was the best actor in the world.
No,
period.
But she's a name.
But
she's
ain't.
Like, yeah, but she's got like headline cred. But like, yeah, I've always found her kind of annoying and disliked her, and I've seen her in a lot of things, and she's fine, whatever. But like, I just have this irrational dislike of her, and I've always felt like an asshole because why? How do you dislike someone you don't even know? Whatever. But
well,
this just it super
reason.
Validates that.
Here's your reason. What? Here's your
yeah,
reason.
Yeah. Well, now she I is. Know. It means that like I am just so in tune with people's inner. Inner self, inner something. What's the word I'm looking for? I know what's in her heart, clearly. And so
you've got your finger on the pulse. I mean, I have enjoyed Scarlett Johansson's one-note acting as Black Widow. I
no,
did not need
I
a Black Widow movie. But
I
I've enjoyed it because there's something, like, she has zero affect, you know?
Yeah.
And so I kind of appreciate it in that role specifically. I do not need her in any other role ever, you know? But absolutely do not need her playing the role of Dante Gill. So moving on from that bullshit.
Trash.
Do I have time for one more pop culture?
No.
Damn. Okay. Maybe we can do it in the main because I want to, you know, talk about Serena Williams if we can.
Yeah.
And that's actually a larger discussion because I want to talk about Serena Williams and about women, you know.
I want to talk about, we had a really nice moment with, yes, talk about Serena Williams in like 2 minutes. doing too,
okay,
too
so Serena Williams is the best. She's the greatest of all time. She is the president, vice president, secretary, pro tem of my life. And so anyway, she was recently asked in an interview if she ever felt the burden of being the greatest, because another tennis player had said it must be hard to be Serena Williams because you have to be better than everyone. Everyone expects you to be better than everyone else. You can never have an off day. And also, you know that everyone is bringing their A game when they play you. So you always have to be even better than that. And so the reporter, you know, asked her if she agreed. And, Serena straight up, like, no hemming, no hawing, no, you know, shucking and jiving, no moonwalking around the issue, was like, I am the greatest. And the reason why I am the greatest is because everyone does, they move heaven and earth to beat me. And so I have to do even more than that to beat them. And so the fact that I am consistently able to do that proves that I'm the greatest. I'm paraphrasing what she said. You should go check out the
we'll link it, the
interview. Yeah, we'll link it to you. But I just loved how she refuses to apologize for being dominant in her sport, which is absolutely unforgivable for a Black woman in any field, but especially athletics. You know, the horrific things and the horrific insults and charges that have been leveled at Serena Williams would have brought me to my knees 47 times a day before this. You know, and I definitely would have tried, I would have denied my own talent as a way of hopefully kind of avoiding that. She refuses to do that. The more people deny her, the more people dismiss her, the more they try and, you know, rewrite history such that she's not the greatest athlete of all time, the more she makes you reckon with, you know, the truth. And, you know, I said this yesterday, like, facts are facts. Math is math, man. 2 + 2 = 4. You can not like it. It doesn't matter. You know, if the sun is shining, if the sun ain't shining, doesn't matter if you had breakfast today or not. Serena Williams is the GOAT. Believe it.
Mm-hmm. On that note, let's talk about a boring movie. I can't wait till they make the Serena Williams biopic.
Oh my God.
Can she just play herself in it though? Because I don't want to deal with that casting. Okay. We all went to see Ant-Man and the Wasp, which is the sequel to the 2015 movie in which women are completely sidelined. It's called Ant-Man. Woo. That was a terrible intro. All right. So, okay, here's the thing. We talked about this yesterday because we've obviously already recorded this podcast.
I kind of know what's coming and I'm excited to hear it again.
But I actually am like more mad at the movie because, so here's the thing is like as a media critic, if you're asked to talk about a movie when you walk out of the movie theater, you're going to have a different interpretation of it than you're going to a week later when it sat with you and when you've discussed it, when you whatever. And so we had a whole conversation yesterday about it. And like, I hate it more today than I did yesterday. Yesterday, I was like, meh, it was fine. And today I'm like, you know what? Fuck this shit. And part of what makes me mad is that like,
I do too.
It is, and this movie is a damsel in distress movie, and it does a really good job of trying to pretend that it's not. It does a good job of masking that that's not what's happening. But the entire fucking movie is predicated on the A plot of we have to save our mother and wife that is stuck in the quantum realm for the last 30 years. And so everything is hinging on the success of that or of that happening. And I'm like, and the more I think about it, the more I'm like, fuck you. Why is nobody talking about this? Why is this okay? I'm yelling. Sorry.
I don't think people are talking about it because this movie is such a piece of like cotton candy ephemera that although there are a multitude of things we could talk about, the movie resists it because it's so effortlessly banal. Okay, so I did not hate this movie.
I didn't hate it either.
There were parts of it that I absolutely loved, and those were parts that were about Michael Pena, about Walton Goggins, or with Randall Park. Like I said this yesterday, like y'all. At me if you want to. I don't care about Paul Rudd. I feel like no matter how much people try and tell me that that I should care about him, that I should be amazed by the fact that he doesn't appear to age, that he is an affable guy, whatever. I don't know. I feel like that's just not in my ministry. I can't. I I can't do it.
I just feel like he's always doing the bare minimum. Like,
girl,
he's not...
but doing it and getting the most acclaim.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah,
people just love them some Paul Rudd, and he seems like a great guy. But I don't need all this Paul Ruddishness.
Yeah,
you know. So I feel like Ant-Man, like this kind of tertiary film in the Marvel pantheon, is perfect for a dude with his abilities, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's a ton of stuff to talk about. Like, you know, let's talk about the ableism, you know, with Ghost in this movie. Let's talk about the fact that, yeah, Damsel in Distress, it's not just, you know, the Wasp mom, but Ghost herself, right? Like, there's a whole Damsel in Distress B-plot about her. Let's talk about the fact that, you know, this movie fails to engage with the kind of, you know, science progress for its own sake and the damage that wreaks upon people's lives. Like, there's a lot of shit we could talk about, but this movie just exhausts you with its banality in so many ways. You're just like, oh, forget it. You know, I'll yeah. save myself for the Avengers.
It's also, it's very... It's not a complex film, but there's so much fucking happening in it with so many different motivations and like attempts to thwart and, you know, whatever, that like it's easy to be distracted from like what is actually happening in the film. And there are definitely some like I think I laughed out loud twice during the whole thing. Like there's some moments that are genuinely funny, like the scene with the truth serum.
The scene is so good.
Yeah,
Michael Peña,
really
like,
good.
He's just, oh my gosh. He should have Paul Rudd's career. He's just amazing.
I don't feel as strongly against Paul Rudd as all of you both do. I think that I think you're right. Like, he's fine casting for this role because it's so banal. And, like, I don't disenjoy watching him on screen.
I don't dislike Paul Rudd at all. I feel like Paul Rudd is like pasta salad at the barbecue. It's fine. I'm not going to head to it first.
It's
and
consistent.
I really resent people being like, you need to have more pasta salad. And then, you know, saying that I should have pasta salad at every meal. Like, I'm fine having a little bit of pasta salad every once in a while.
Yeah.
That's all I need.
Let's actually get into Ghost and this character, because this is the first time we're introduced to her in the Marvel universe. And I don't know if she's ever going to show up again. But I wanted her to be a lot cooler than she was. Her costume was amazing. It looked
yes.
straight out of Star Wars. It felt very weird in this universe.
You know, to me, it looked like, you know, those shitty G.I. Joe movies that came out?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, 5-6 years ago or whatever. It felt like one of those movies,
oh,
which tells you everything you need to know about this shitty media I watch.
I haven't seen
but like, so Ebony, you were talking about how like there are some ableist narratives around this character. You want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, okay, because thank God there are smarter people than me out there in the universe. Some disabled activists that I follow on Twitter were mentioning that an aspect of the film that they didn't feel like was getting enough discussion was the presentation of Ghost, who is a woman of color. Her father is white, her mother is black. This woman of color as a disabled character specifically. She lives with chronic pain, debilitating chronic pain, because, you know, due to this, you know, experiment of her father's, she is unable to prevent her cells from constantly phasing. So she is sort of unable to, you know, lock herself into place, and it causes her constant pain. And so there's this very kind of ableist narrative attached to thinking of her, like trying to return her to a state that is not disabled, looking for a cure and kind of erasing her lived reality and not really living through what it would mean for someone to exist in that kind of space. And it was something I honestly hadn't thought about, and I was glad to have someone kind of, you know, walk me through that. So yeah, we'll put the link for the specific piece that I'm one of the pieces that I read about this specific issue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's something to celebrate is, yeah, like one of the things that we don't often see with disabled characters in mainstream media is that those are usually white characters. Like, you know, the hashtag disability so white. For the most part, people of color who are disabled are routinely erased from our media narratives. So it was great to have a woman of color playing that role. But the way that it was treated and then the way that it sort of fixed at the end, Just, you know, kind of had some problematic aspects to it that that I was grateful to have someone point out to me.
I thought her characterization was super weird. Like, they didn't really know what to do with her. I think they were trying to make her, like, complex, but didn't know how to do it. So they just kept changing her fucking hair. So, like, they gave her pigtails at one point, and then, like, then her hair was down, and then she was back in pigtails. And, like, I don't think the actor knew what to do with it either. So she went to these, like, these extremes that felt... like bad acting to me. Like, and I don't really know Hannah John Kamen, who plays her, so she might be a wonderful actor and had nothing to work with in this material, but like, she was like, I'm sweet and nice and I'm gonna get what I need, and then I'm big tough blah blah blah, and I'm gonna, and now I'm kind of like super wild and, like, you know, out of control because I'm so upset about being dying, kind of thing. Like, it was so all over the place that
I kind of loved her portrayal because I just thought that she was so expressive. Her face just carried so much emotion. But I do think that the film itself couldn't decide whether to infantilize her or to make her a really, you know, kind of frightening antagonist. And so, yeah, there's the whole pigtails thing, but, you know, sometimes the way that she kind of talks and carries herself, you know, as if she's sort of demanding to be taken care of, you know.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Jigsaw is the fake dead guy on the floor.
Like, I hope Phil put 47 spoiler alerts, you know, before this, but like Lawrence Fishburne's character, who is revealed to be someone who's aiding her, right? Like, there's all this stuff going on with like fathers and daughters and children. Yeah. And but like, so sometimes she's very heavily infantilized, and then other times she is presented as like this force of nature, right, who is almost not even human.
Well, I think that part of the reason there was that like inconsistency is because the Ghost character is originally a white dude in the comics, and they switched the character significantly for the movie. And it seems like whoever wrote the character and whoever was giving this actress direction, like, possibly did not fully know how to execute that choice in a way that would service the story in the best way, which sucks because I liked the acting choices being made, even when the character was behaving, I thought, sometimes confusingly.
Yeah.
But it's choices like that, I feel like they're just such big missed opportunities, because on paper you're like, oh, that's amazing, and like that could be such an effective choice, but then when the filmmakers are not equipped to know how to make that choice effective, then it happens less in the future, and it's just like, man, I feel like that could have worked so much more effectively if it seems like she just was being directed weirdly, right? Like,
yeah, that was what I was thinking as you were talking too, that I'm like, I feel like she just got really confused direction.
Yeah.
And that, like, the direct, like, the her, who, yeah, yeah, yeah. She's trying to like adjust to that, even though it feels so all over the place.
Well, the film is all over the place, right? Like, there are three or four movies packed into this, you know, 97 minute, you know, spectacular here. Like, the movie, to my mind, if it was going to be about rescuing Janet Van Dyne from the quantum realm, which we definitely need to talk about the fucking banana soup of the quantum realm and how that made no sense on this earth or any other earth, okay? But if the movie was solely about that, and then either Sonny Birch, Walton Goggins' character, you know, trying to prevent that from occurring or trying to steal the technology, that would have been one great movie, right? Or if it had been about the development of this technology and Ghost trying to steal it, that would have been another great thing. But the fact that you had so many competing narrative threads made it so that I did not care. And, you know, I hadn't seen the first Ant-Man, and I have no desire to, but I was just like, was the first one
it's
like
better
this?
Than
just
this.
This kind of like mishmash of stuff. It just felt like everything they wanted to talk about, they were going to talk about. And I do wonder if it's because everything in the Marvel Universe is so carefully plotted in the family tree, right? So we know that we're going to get the Captain Marvel movie in March of next year, and then a couple of months later, we'll get the next Avengers movie. You know, we know for a fact that there's some shit that came up in Ant-Man and the Wasp that's going to bear on what happens in those two movies. So is that why there was so much going on? Who knows?
I think it's a sequel issue. Like, because, you know, if you look at, this is not a great example, but if you look at the, remember the Nolan's Batman movies, how, like, it basically one movie ended and another movie started again, and you're like, why are there 20 villains and why are there 20 movies in this one movie?
Yeah.
Like, that, I think that that's what, that's sort of, like, set a precedent. I'm totally talking out of my ass right now, but I think that that may have set a precedent for making these like big epic action superhero movies where they just have to be so full of like so much going on. And I don't actually think Marvel does that too much. Like, I think that their stories can be pretty basic and they fluff them up with more character personality. This one in particular had so many competing motivations. And also, like, there were 5 writers credited on this. Paul Rudd was one of them.
Ugh, which is, like, not a good sign.
It's not a good sign. It's really not. And so you're just like, did some of these people come in after and have to, like, salvage the plot? Or, like, was this a, like, during filming, they rewrote chunks of it, which is also a thing that happens sometimes. So
I just want to know who wrote the truth serum scene and punched that up, because when Michael Peña's character talks about listening to Morrissey, who he called Maz, right, the way that people in the Mexican American community do, I got my entire life, and I was just like, either there was a, you know, Mexican American writer on this film, or maybe Michael Peña had some like buy-in here, but that's not just a line that like just. I think anyway, they're just like some random white guy would write. Like, it was so pitch perfect and like culturally specific in a way we don't often get. Oh my God. Like, that just delighted me to no end.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Sorry. One thing that like the more I think about it, like between yesterday and today, the more it bugs me is like the sheer number of father-daughter narratives, like shoehorned into a single movie is and yesterday I was like, I don't know, maybe it's nice that we're like, oh, Paul Rudd is like kind of a deadbeat dad, but also kind of a good dad. And the more I think about it, I just want to put it out there, the more I find it fucking annoying and weird, and I can't even really articulate why, but it's like, okay, you know, so much of the Wasp story is like her relationship to her father and her lack of real relationship to her mother. And then it's like Paul Rudd also is struggling to be a dad, but also his kid is obsessed with him and so cute. And I don't know, just like every time it's like, okay, there are a lot of female characters in this story, but it's like they're talking about their daddies a lot. And I don't love that. I don't love that.
It's gross. It reminds me of Law & Order SVU. Christopher Maloney's character was named Elliot Stabler. Whenever he was having like a particularly like tough moment dealing with, you know, one of the pervert of the week, he would mention the fact that he has daughters. And I straight up, when I watched that show, I was like, this dude has 38 daughters. I felt like there were so many fucking daughters in his house, right? And this felt the same way. I think in movies of this type, characters who deal with, characters are best suited to advance the narrative aims of a fiction like this when they are dealing with absent mothers and present fathers. Yeah. And so you have, you know, like a child can grieve a lost mother, but the true trauma would be if they lost their cool, you know, genius dad.
And there,
you know, or fun time dad.
And there is something about the father-daughter narrative as it's presented in this movie, and I think in a lot of others, where there is just like this weird self-congratulatory tone to like seeing a dad be a good dad on screen. Like, it's just like there may as well be like fireworks going off, and they're like, look, he did it. When like that is rarely extended to motherhood. It's assumed that you will be a good mother. You have to be a good mother. And, you know, the story will come down on you harder if you're not. And whereas like Paul Rudd shows up 2 times and they're like, woohoo, he's like an iconic father. And I don't know. I'm just like, no, you don't get points for showing up. That's literally your job.
Right. Although I have to say, I loved Bobby Cannavale's kind of effusive affection for Paul Rudd's character. Mm-hmm. You know, like we don't often see
that was nice. Yeah.
Like co-parents and step-parents being shown as, you know, being friendly, collegial, being loving with each other, you know,
like
in the service of the child's well-being. I actually really, really dug that. But yeah, like I loved Paul Rudd as a dad in this movie with his, you know, cardboard
that,
roller coaster.
Like, he does like, get Dad bomb. Of the Year award for that fucking playground. Yo, I'm just saying.
Yeah. The playground was dumb.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hear you on everything else, but that playground is definitely points. I would like to talk about how the science of the quantum realm makes zero fucking sense.
Please.
In terms of
girl.
The internal
okay.
content. I don't
Let
know
me
shit
get my
about
notes
quantum
ready.
Physics, but like in the internal logic of the film, it doesn't even make sense because at the beginning, they literally say there is no linear time in the quantum realm. So how the fuck does Michelle Pfeiffer know that 30 years have passed?
Why does her hair go gray? Why does she get older?
Is aging happen the same way?
That's what
does
I'm
she
saying.
Not like, go and, does she not go like totally banana soup from the...
From being alone for 30
yeah,
years?
Yeah, for 30 yeah. years. If there is time. But if there's no linear time, then you wouldn't have any sense of time.
Okay, y'all, seriously though. I'm not... This would have been hilarious, right? If they had rescued her and she had still been like 30 years old and she was like, yo, my husband is an old man. My daughter is older than I was. I cannot handle this. Put me back in the quantum realm. I try not to be that person who picks apart plot holes. I'm lying. I totally try it.
What?
I'm that person who picks apart plot holes. But no, I'm trying to get better. But I think like as long as a show or a film or a book is internally consistent,
yes.
It doesn't matter how ludicrous or improbable the hand-wavy, sciency-wancy stuff is, as long as it's internally consistent. What drove me bonkers is that, yes, I was like, no, by the standards of your own narrative, this doesn't make any sense. Either time is linear or it's not. Like, you can't have it both ways simply because you decided to stunt cast Michelle Pfeiffer and you didn't have the money to CGI her into young Pfeiffer the entire time. Also, stop youngifying people. When we saw this in, like,
Dude.
Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and yeah. it was Kurt Russell, I did a hallelujah holler lap around that entire theater. I was laughing so hard.
It was
stop
hilarious.
Doing this. Stop.
I mean,
stop,
it's okay.
Stop making
like
Tupac
every,
holograms like, and stop youngifying these folks. We don't need it.
And it's distracting. We know what they look like. Like, it's right? I'm like, why are you? Does this movie think I'm first of all too fucking dumb to know how time works, and second of all,
right?
too fucking dumb to like hit Google image for Michelle Pfeiffer? Like, I know what she looks like. Stop trying
right.
to trick me.
I know yeah. they look like gross sex dolls. Like the skin
do.
Texture is not right.
The last thing I want to bring up just really quick before we move on is the scene where Michelle Pfeiffer's character takes over Paul Rudd's body. I think that he's pretending to be a woman, so his voice changes somehow, which is kind of like it's all set up for comedic laughs. And like, I get why they did it that way. But the part that really I was questioning was like, oh, he starts holding the hand of what's his fuck? The dad.
What's Hank Pym.
Yeah, Hank Pym. And like, so is it homophobic, right? Like, is the comedy of this funny because you have a man who's pretending to be a woman and is in love with this other man, which like they didn't like go super hard on like, oh, I can't believe we're holding hands right now. But there was a little bit of like, that's the underlying theme here, right? Like if we didn't live in a homophobic society, in a transphobic society, then this wouldn't even be funny, would it?
I didn't think the fact of the two men sharing that emotional moment, it's like, not to say that you're wrong, but I didn't have that immediate reaction. The thing that, you know, kind of pulled me out of it, God bless him, Paul Rudd is just not a good actor. And so when they say that, when the director says like, okay, Janet Van Dyne is now speaking through your body. She has inhabited your brain and she's saying the things to her husband and her daughter that she wants to say and trying to guide them. Paul Rudd's, you know, acting ability only allows him to do this very kind of stereotypical, like effeminate voice that was so off-putting, you know? Like it completely negated any actual emotion from the scene because it sounded like a joke.
I feel like when most people do these things, like their voices don't, the tone of their voices don't change. The way that they talk changes.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, because I'm trying to think of other films and movie and shows that have done this. And you're like, you either become more robotic because you're an alien or whatever, right? As opposed to like, I am now talking like a girl.
But
which
Paul
apparently
Rudd,
that's what we sound like.
He visibly becomes more limp in that scene. Like his body, like he's attempting to demonstrate that he's become softer, you know? And so he doesn't slump necessarily, but he's not standing as tall. His body goes softer. It becomes more limp. His hands come up like they're not, you know, in a sort of, you know, stereotypically kind of, you know, masculine stance anymore.
Yeah.
And I just felt like a better director would have been like, no, this is, what are you doing? You know, like
you're I think that it was
it
directed. I'm sure this was directed exactly as it was directed to, because it was played for laughs, right? Like that, it's funny to do this.
So you're saying I should stop blaming Paul Rudd for everything?
I don't know. I was kind of blaming Paul Rudd as well.
Paul Rudd has what?
I was
you think
kind.
It's his fault too?
I was kind of blaming Paul Rudd for that as well.
I think
Jamie and I are taking over Feminist Frequency.
Yeah, you can do that. I think Paul Rudd has good comedic timing. I mean, I think he's fine. I think that this was like, I think the direction here was specifically to be like this. And I think it's really, I don't think it's explicitly homophobic, but I think it's definitely bordering on it. And in our current society, like there is, I think it was, it's something worth noting, right? I'm not being like, how dare they do this thing? But like, this isn't exactly, you could have done something better here, you know?
It's certainly not as like egregious as like Jack Black in Jumanji. But I feel like it
was a choice
along those lines where my guess is, I guess, sort of somewhere between Ebony and Anita of like Paul Rudd's instincts were to play it for laughs and to make it super silly. And just sort of no one told him to dial it back and no one told him to think harder about it, because I don't think people tell Paul Rudd to do anything but be Paul Rudd. And that is perhaps his curse in his life. I don't know.
That's
why he'll never improve at anything.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I don't want people to come out of this thinking that I hate Paul Rudd. I don't. I love him in Wet Hot
American
Summer.
Paul Rudd.
You know, listen, don't send Paul Rudd stands after me. We just talked about what happens when Twitter mobs get activated. I just am saying Paul Rudd is the pasta salad at the barbecue. I just want a little bit. I don't want seconds. Quit trying to make me have so much pasta salad.
All right. Do or don't see Ant-Man. We don't really care.
Oh, no, watch it, but wait till it's on Netflix. And don't put it on your own Netflix. Like, you know, sign on to your brother's Netflix account and then watch it.
Yeah, you don't want those recommendations. You don't want it to fuck up your Netflix recommendations.
Yeah, you don't want to your algorithms, and you don't want to pay for it.
All right, y'all. Let's do some freaking out. So... I'm not going to go there. Okay, whatever. I was going to do a whole title debate and see where Jamie lied on the title.
No,
but we
because
don't need to
we
do that shit
listen.
Again.
We've already determined that, you know, Jamie in a blind taste testing preferred. What's your freak out? Let's move past it. I'm trying to heal.
I'm sorry for driving a rift. It really.
We were already about to get divorced. Don't worry about it.
But I just can't. I just can't let Ebony go. Ebony?
Yes.
What's your do you have a freak out or a deal this week? How about that?
Oh boy. I am straddling the line. Okay, so originally I was freaking out because I just finished watching season 2 of Fringe. Y'all know that was my official freak out last week. I just started watching Fringe because I was like, I need more John Noble in my life. This seems like the easiest way to get it. But then I ran into the obstacle that the DVDs I needed were not at the library, and I'm not even trying to pay $30 to buy that season on Amazon Prime, you know, so whatever. So I had to stop watching Fringe for a minute. Which is good because I was having trouble processing how gun happy that show is. And the more I think about it, the more I think about the obvious parallels to a show like The X-Files, right? Like it's deliberately set up as sort of a modern day X-Files. I could be wrong. I usually am. But one of the things that I appreciated about The X-Files is that there was a very real sense, I haven't seen the new seasons, by the way, but there's a very real sense in the original run that the FBI and law enforcement were not the friends of the public. and that in fact, that they were actively antagonistic to the public in many ways, and that you could not count on the government to necessarily have the well-being of the people at heart. Like, it seemed to me that the show very deliberately framed the FBI as one of the villains, right? Especially the upper echelons at the FBI. One of the things that bothers me about Fringe is the way in which it sort of unquestioningly asks us to assume that everything that is done in the service of protecting people from these wild fringe occurrences, like no matter what has happened, that the FBI division that is tasked with preventing it can be trusted, and all of their decisions can be trusted. And I'm talking specifically about, as I said, how gun happy the show is. Like, people just get straight up grenaded, murdered, just constantly. And I'm having a hard time reconciling my love for the main characters with that. See, I was trying to do a short lead-in to say that that wasn't my freak out this week. Clearly, I'm still freaking out about it so much.
Yeah.
Fringe
yeah,
is the answer.
You I wasn't gonna time.
Yeah, I was going to freak out about Black Sails, which I started watching.
Next
because,
week.
Whoa, holy shit, do I have a lot to talk about. But I'll bring that up next week.
All right, Jamie, what is your freak out this week?
My freak out this week is sorry to bring us back to Paul Rudd literally immediately, but I saw The 40-Year-Old Virgin for the first time over the weekend, and I cannot get over how it is a movie that came out and was successful. And I just
did you have to watch this movie for work? Or
I did, yeah,
because you lost a bet. Okay.
I meant that would be like peak, like, okay, I need to make some life changes if I just voluntarily watch The 40-Year-Old Virgin just to see. Like,
I didn't want to suggest that, but I was gonna be like, let's talk about the decisions that you're
let's
making,
talk about your choices and your lifestyle,
let's talk about the people you're hanging out with and how they maybe aren't good for you.
I don't even want to encourage people to rewatch it, but I was truly floored. And I have a pretty like high tolerance for like, oh yeah, this movie is going to be bad, and it'll be bad in ways that are predictable and blah, blah, blah. But this movie is bad in just like every frame of it is bad and offensive. And there's an issue in every line of dialogue except one that I could find in the entire movie. I think that Judd Apatow is just like a cultural terrorist. I think he's the worst, and I feel that he should just stop. I think he should stop. I think the one person I support deporting from this country is Seth Rogen. He's Canadian. People forget. And it's just
don't want him.
We don't want him. We don't need
him.
No,
I'm a Canadian. We don't want him.
Oh, well.
You'll find somewhere else.
I feel like he could be rehabilitated in Canada. I don't know. he's not doing anyone any good here. He's just pushing Steve Carell into these compromising situations and making him sexually harass Elizabeth Banks. There's one scene in that movie where literally it's Paul Rudd and Seth Rogen are outside of like the Best Buy in the movie, smashing glass and talking about how Steve Carell was stupid to not date rape a woman. That's a scene. They're smashing glass while it's just, I'm like, this is.
Because it's really macho.
And it's so chill to be smashing glass
bond.
While talking about date rape. I'm like, this is cartoonishly bad. It's the worst. Oh, and I can't stand anything Judd Apatow does, but this was the most egregiously, like, my blood pressure did rise, and I had I think I said this yesterday too, I had to go on like a 2 mile long rage walk when it was over. And
were you walking and like punching the air?
And it was like a little bit too late, but I'm like, this will not stand. I can't remain in my home and just sleep with the knowledge that this movie exists. I have to sweat it out.
I feel like when you watch movies I think it's okay. Actually, rephrase. Movies more recently, I think that we have a higher standard of like not allowing sexist, racist shit in movies recently. I mean, it happens,
for sure.
But like there are these specific movies from like the aughts, like the late 90s aughts. So you go back and watch them and you think that they were fine because you didn't have a awareness of how to interpret film back then or have any lens. And like they're just, it's like every fucking punchline is sexist or racist or homophobic. And you kind of forget, right? And I think these are a time capsule of where we were as a society not very long ago.
Bush era, like, big budget comedies are just a fucking nightmare. It's wild. Yeah. Like, not like we've come that far, but at least Judd Apatow is not allowed to make these movies anymore. Like, and just the fact that the movie was so successful. And I'm like, okay, so
it was a big deal. Yeah.
No one had a problem with it. It's so, oh, God.
Yeah.
God. Yeah.
All right, my freak out this week is that I binged all two seasons of The Good Fight. I forgot that I had the CBS All Access subscription that we've apparently been paying for because of Star Trek Discovery, which isn't worth it for that horrible show. But, you know, you should listen to me and Ebony's podcast about how much we hate it every week, which will come back eventually.
I did right. not hate it.
You didn't hate Star Trek Discovery?
Once it got to the end and it Ebony. Was full tilt disco banana soup,
oh, that's
I
true.
Was
you
in
liked,
it to win it.
That's right.
Oh,
I hated
God.
It. Yeah. Ebony was delighted in its
I
bullshit.
I was so delighted.
Anyways, don't take over my freak out with that bullshit. All right.
That's what I'm here for.
I know. But The Good Fight, it's a spinoff of The Good Wife, which is a highly popular show. The Good Fight is incredibly watchable. My friend who suggested it to me described it that way, and I understand, because it's not like a show that you're like, this is such a good show, but like, it is definitely one of those shows where you can just like watch the shit out of it, and you can binge it and just like do that whole like spend an entire weekend watching it. The reason I bring it up is because I am utterly baffled at the fact that CBS is paying for this show to exist. And I know it's on their all-access streaming service. I don't know why I keep plugging CBS.
Secret plug.
I'm just proud that I remembered the name of something. But it is, so it is Diane Lockhart, who was on The Good Wife. It takes place a year after the end of that show, and they are about to retire. They try to pull their money out of their retirement fund to buy a villa in France, blah, blah, blah. They give their notice at their law firm. And then the money that their retirement fund is in is actually a Ponzi scheme, and everything gets frozen and she loses all of her money. Wah, 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 whatever. Fucking 1% problems.
Wow.
But so then she can't find a job because she was friends with the people that ran a Ponzi scheme, et cetera, et cetera. She can't get her job back, all of this shit. She's about to lose her lavish lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera. And she gets hired by an all-black law firm. She's white, in case people are not clear on this fact. So the show then takes place as her, as a white woman, at this law firm that is generally progressive, right? So some of their biggest cases are about suing the city of Chicago or the state of Illinois. I'm not sure exactly how that distinction happens for police brutality cases. And so they talk about that, and the show is grappling with and dealing with living under Trump and existing under Trump and laws in this current climate. And there's so much stuff that's very, very current that I'm kind of surprised about that they're like grappling with. And the show is progressive. I don't know. Like, it's I don't agree with everything that they talk about. And I don't think that they land on like the right side all the time. But they're definitely talking about these issues. Like, there's an episode where they basically are like, ICE is bullshit. And ICE is out of their jurisdiction and keeps trying to deport people when they're technically not allowed to. And it's the whole episode is them trying to keep someone in jail just so ICE can't access them in state, like in the state instead of federal. I'm just a little bit blown away by it. I need to go read all the think pieces to see how this show exists and why it even exists as it does. I'm very confused. Anyways, so if anyone is watching it, hit me up on Twitter, because I want to talk to people about this, because I just like I keep ruining hanging out with my friends by being like, I have to tell you about this show and this episode and this episode and then this. It's not fun. It's not fun to hang out
with me. I think it's fun. And, you know, I love when we ask for people to give us feedback. Like, I legitimately need to talk about this show, Black Sails. I just started watching it. I'm only like 4 episodes in to the first season, and I want to write 17 doctoral dissertations on this shit. So I need to get this out. But I'm afraid to just dive into the fandom as a newbie, Because I feel like the shit that I want to talk about has probably been covered ad infinitum. So I need someone to hold my hand as I go through the valley of the shadow of Black Sails.
All right, y'all, that is our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Remember that you too can listen to the epic story of why Jamie Loftus has a Zamboni tattoo by joining our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Go do that right now. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review us on iTunes. And okay, we wanted you to tell your friends about our show. So when you're in the quantum realm and you're at the tardigrade cookout and you're like, hey, just watch this thing, listen to this podcast, you should be like, yo, you should check out Feminist Frequency Radio because they are very smart when it comes to talking about science, clearly.
Don't bring potato salad to the tardigrade cookout.
No, they don't like that.
Word solidify.
You can check out all, but you could bring pasta salid.
Did you say pasta?
If
you
I did,
don't
I'm
shut
Canadian.
Your Canadian self down and end this episode, girl, bye.
You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. So be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all of the news. Jamie, it was such a pleasure having you. If people want to learn more about you or if you have anything to plug, please share that now.
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter at Jamie Loftus Help, and I have a weekly podcast called The Bechdel Cast, which is a deep dive into how women are portrayed in movies, and that comes out every Thursday on the How Stuff Works Network.
I have a very quick question.
Yeah.
Is it Jamie Loftus Help because you are seeking help or you're giving help?
It's, well, it really depends on the day.
Yeah.
I got fair. Teaser for the Zamboni bonus. I used to have a very different Twitter account for 10 years. And then I got, I tweeted too much about the Winter Olympics and the IOC had me banned. So I had to restart my Twitter.
Holy shit.
What?
Damn. Okay. More content for the bonus.
Yep.
Ebony. Where nobody cares about you after that story.
No, I don't either.
Where can people find you?
You can find me at Enough Pasta Salad, which is my business account, or you can find me at Ebony Aster, which I check, I don't know, 100,000 times a day.
Yeah, it's like every minute. Our co-host Carolyn Michelle is at... Or Carolyn Pettit is at Carolyn Michelle. I'm at Anita Sarkeesian. I'm going to stop talking now. No, I'm not. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed her theme music. We'll see you next week. Bye.
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 Oh, boy.